Let's get started promptly. I appreciate you all coming back on time. So one thing, is there a Sarah McCracken in the crowd? Sarah, can you see Pat at the desk? There's a question about your email. Okay. All right. Great. So, great. Our next speaker is Lynn Mayans. So Lynn is a licensed social worker. She has her own private practice in Concord, New Hampshire. You may have seen her books out on the table. If not, feel free to go out and grab a copy before you leave today. I'll just read a little bit about her bio. With a special interest in breaking the generational cycle of worry in families, she's the co-author of two books on anxiety. And her latest book is Using Hypnosis with Children, Creating and Delivering Effective Interventions, a how-to guide for helping professionals looking to incorporate hypnotic strategies for the treatment of depression, anxiety, medical procedures, pain, and sleep. Lynn received her BA in English from Williams College and her master's in social work from Boston University. And has been training in clinical hypnosis and strategic therapy since 1993. So we received many requests, and I think many of you probably have seen Lynn. I haven't, so it's a great opportunity for me. And Lynn will be speaking to us for 2 hours.
2 hours, yay. All right. Hi, everybody. It's nice to see some familiar faces. If you've seen me speak before to school nurses, you know that you are my people. I love when I get to talk to school nurses because in terms of worry and anxiety, you guys are on the front lines and you get it and you see it. So it's always a pleasure when I'm invited to speak to a group of school nurses. This actually was, I was walking in, this was where I had my first job after graduate school. I graduated from BU in May. I got married in June. My husband started at the business school in August, and we moved up here, and I took a job in one of the inpatient psychiatry units that's no longer the same as it was then. So it's a little flashback. That was such a long time ago. Joan and I were reminiscing because we were here the day they moved from the Hanover campus to here. And that was quite a day. If any of you participated in that, it was really something. So it was quite a year, actually. So we're going to talk about worry. Yay! So worry is a problem. Anxiety is a problem. People tell me all the time, gosh, it feels like it's epidemic. It feels like it's out of control. What's going on? We're seeing it all the time. Schools are calling me. I have tons of school districts saying, you know, it's exploding. What's the problem? What we don't know, really, is whether or not diagnosable anxiety disorders have really exploded the way it feels like they've exploded. It's certainly increased. It's certainly more common than it used to be. But whether or not it's so out of control, it might have gone from maybe 1 in 15 kids, and then it sort of edged its way up to 1 in 12, and now you'll see maybe 1 in 10. Sometimes you see 1 in 8, and the really pessimistic people say 1 in 5. I don't think it's 1 in 5. What we really notice with anxiety in this culture of ours, because anxiety and worry are really a cultural thing, is that this country, this culture right now, we're not doing a very good job, actually. We're cranking out these little worriers like nobody's business. It's great for job security, but it's really not great for the future of our country. What we're seeing, and I've been doing this for a long time, so it's no surprise to me, is that university mental health centers are overrun at this point with kids that aren't able to cope emotionally when they're on their own. So we're not equipping kids. If you've heard me speak before, you've heard me say, I am a how therapist, not a why therapist. I'm much more interested in teaching skills. I'm incredibly concrete. Every time there's a kid in front of me, a family in front of me, I am thinking to myself, what are the resources that I have in order that I can use those resources, and what are the skills that this kid doesn't have, and how do I teach it? So very much about saying, let's figure out what this kid needs to do, to be able to do, what does his family need to be able to do in order to step forward into whatever is coming next. When kids leave for college, if they are not able to manage uncertainty, if they don't have a sense of their own independence, if they are not good problem solvers, they run into trouble. And there was a recent article that somebody sent me, which made a lot of sense, saying that when we see kids going off out of school into college, or even just off on their own, joining the military, whatever they're doing after when they're leaving home, the signs that they were going to not do well didn't just show up when they arrived at college. And what's happening is we are being so careful to sort of move these kids through and then saying, okay, so we got you through, now you're on your own. And what I say to parents all the time is that our job is not to keep the train on the tracks. That's impossible. Our job is that when the train goes off the tracks, children and teenagers and young adults know how to get the train back on. And that's where things fall apart, is that when something happens, what do you do next? So when we're thinking about worry and anxiety, we have to start thinking about what it is that kids need. Those are the three things, particularly if we're looking at families with worried parents, lousy at tolerating uncertainty, not very good independent problem solvers, and they score low on the autonomy scales. So people say to me, as I said before, well, what's going on? Why are we having this huge problem with anxiety? Why is it exploding? It's really our fault. The parents, my generation, we're the post-9/11 generation. We're worriers. And worry is driving a lot of this. What we're doing, actually, is we're projecting the danger of the world onto our children. The language that we use, the media, the absolute overwhelming influx of bad news is making parents nuts. And the research shows that the leash that we are allowing our children out here is getting shorter and shorter. There are plenty of people who I see who will not let their children play alone out in the backyard or the front yard. In New Hampshire, right? It's really... these stamps were created several years ago to coincide with Michelle Obama's Let's Get Moving campaign. You never saw these stamps. They were never released. Because the activities depicted on these stamps were determined by some committee, the Committee on Neurotic Parenting or whatever it was called, determined that these stamps depicted activities that were too dangerous and risky for your children to see on their water bill or their electric bill. I'm not making this up. And just so you know, I don't have to make anything up. The stories I tell you, the things I say, I don't have to exaggerate. It's all right there in front of me. So in particular, three stamps were deemed too dangerous. This one right here is a child skateboarding. He's wearing a helmet, but he doesn't have on elbow pads. He might have on knee pads, but we can't tell. This one down here, the crazy cannonball activity. Can't have kids seeing this, right? What message are we sending our children? One of my sons said, maybe that's a puddle, and that's why they deemed it too dangerous. Yeah. And then this is the best one. This is a kid doing a headstand. This was deemed too dangerous because, as you will see, he's not wearing a helmet, and there we have risk of a head injury. This is what we're dealing with. This is what we've created. And now it's coming home to roost. We're seeing it in large numbers. We're seeing kids feeling like the world is a dangerous place, and we're experiencing parents that are really terrified to let their children fail, to let them suffer, to let them experience difficulty, to put them out there and let them figure things out on their own. Did anybody see I think maybe I saw it on a news show recently, where they're in New Zealand, they are making playgrounds more dangerous. Did you see that? They're on a quest to make playgrounds more dangerous. because our kids are sort of, you know, walking around and we're protecting them such that they're feeling ill-equipped. When we tell kids that the world is a dangerous place, and by the way, it's never been a safer time to be a kid in the United States of America than it is right now in terms of accidents, illness, war, all of the things that threaten children's safety right now in the United States, we're doing a really good job with those things. And yet, at the very same time, anxiety and depression have never been higher. We are medicating kids more than ever. And yet right now, anxiety and depression have never been higher. The fastest growing group of depressed people in this country are the 17 to 24-year-olds. 25% of women between the ages of 45 and 55 right now are on an SSRI. 25% of us. Well, that's because they're prescribing it for everything. Right? You're a little hot, take an SSRI. So we have to think prevention. We have to get ahead of this thing. We have to start, instead of thinking, how are we going to treat these pathological problems? Because these diagnostic categories that we're throwing at kids is driving me crazy, too. We have to think, how are we going to get ahead of it? How can we start to equip them preventatively? And prevention works, and it's not that complicated. The mental health field, if you've hung around it for a while, and I've been hanging around it for a long time, likes to complicate things. It likes to make up differential diagnoses and come up with all these categories and talk about this and this and this. And the word comorbidity. If you use that word with a child, they freak out. Comorbidity? What does that mean? I had one little girl come in. She was 6 years old. She sat down. And she said, I said, hello, hi, you're so cute. So every girl that I see is named Sophie, and every boy that I see is named Joshua, just for future reference. So I said, oh, hi, Sophie, how are you? You're so cute. You know, blah, blah, blah. So why are you here? She says, I have 4 significant anxiety disorders. That's what she said. She's in kindergarten. So in my inside voice, I said, so does your mom. I was right. This worry thing runs in families for sure. We know there's a genetic component to it. We know there's a genetic predisposition. But we also know that a lot of the behavior is learned. And anything in which, in the mental health world, and in a lot of things where there's a genetic predisposition, it's not a done deal. It means that you are perhaps more likely temperamentally to develop this disorder. All the more reason to get ahead of it. All the more reason to start equipping kids with what they need in order to manage in the world, rather than using all of this pathological language to predict what's going to be wrong with them. If we start thinking about prevention, if we start thinking about the patterns, this is what we're looking for: emotional management, cognitive management. When you are stepping into the world, you are a human being. That means you are going to feel things. You are going to experience things. You're going to have bad relationships. You're going to get in fights with the people that you love. You have to learn how to connect when it's important and disconnect when it's not important. Being able to say to kids, it's not about stopping you from having feelings, even strong feelings. It's knowing how to react and respond when the feelings show up, including worry, including anxiety. Anxiety and worry are two different things. Worry is the cognitive thing that we do up here. Anxiety is the physical reaction in the body. But we use the terms interchangeably all the time. I do, everyone does. Yeah, but they're two different things. If we talk about how versus why, the mental health profession loves why, historically. If we focus on why, we miss the opportunity to build skills because we waste precious time. When we're talking about anxiety and worry, why is not that hard to figure out, and it generally falls into two categories. Something happened, or it runs in the family, or both. It takes me about 5 minutes to get to the bottom of that question. And when parents say to you, we need to get to the root of this, right? She stopped going to school. Now, once you eliminate the something happened, you don't have to keep looking for answers. When kids are anxious, when kids worry, the why is not the important question. The how are we going to help them manage it is what we want to focus on. Think of if you went to a car mechanic that was focused on why. So your car doesn't start, and you bring your car in, and you say, my car doesn't start. And the mechanic says, well, first we need to do an assessment and figure out why. So go, okay, great, right? That's so he's in there for, you know, a half an hour, 45 minutes. He comes out, and he says, Lynn, I've got a theory. I've got some ideas about why your car isn't starting, and I'd like to share them with you. Go, oh, okay, that would be great. And then we can discuss them, and perhaps you've got some other ideas as well. But it's important for us to really fully understand how the car got to this place. And you're thinking, I don't really care. Just make my car start. We need to discuss it, right? So let me go over that with you. We're going to take our time. We're going to move slowly through this process. So he explains to you why the car won't start, at least what his theory is. And then you go, okay, great. And he says, so what we'll do is next week we'll get together again. And if you have any questions about what we discussed today, we can go over them again. And then we can sort of discuss maybe how we can begin the process of getting your car started again. And you're like, what? And that'll be $150. You're like, but I really just want to know how to start my car. Let's not rush things. Let's take our time. Want to build a connection here. It's important that I get to know you and you get to know me. You're like, no. It's important that you tell me how to start my car. But that's what we do when we're focused on this why thing. It's about action. The why is truly not that complicated. A mom sent me an email recently, and her daughter was having difficulty in school, little elementary school girl, not really making eye contact with people, not really looking at people in the eye, very common, right? Maybe she has selective mutism, maybe she's got social anxiety, whatever you want to label her with. And the mom wrote in the email, she has no reason to behave this way. ! Right? And I thought, ooh, maybe there's a little clue right there. I had somebody else email me recently, and their daughter has been in therapy, and clearly has got some OCD going on. There's a lot of hand washing. There's a lot of not touching clothes. When she gets into bed, she has to get bent a certain way and put the covers up on the certain. And the mom writes, but I keep a clean house. Right? Why is she behaving this way? So once we get rid of that, once we move past that, once we answer that, right? Why? Why are you anxious? Well, look, your mom is anxious. If I'm in a session with a kid and I say to the kid, so which one of your parents is the worrier? They don't go, oh gosh, let me think about this for a while. No. They go, what? And then if I say to that parent, so who taught you how to worry? The little kid says, oh my God, Mimi is out of control. Have you met my grandmother? It's terrible. Right? It's not a mystery. So when we start looking at this intergenerational pattern, what is it that these kids are hearing? How are they perceiving the world? And how do we begin to shift them into different cognitive patterns? The thing about anxiety is that if you do nothing about it, if it persists, and it will, because kids don't generally grow out of this. If it persists, the content will change. They'll worry about different things as they move through the life cycle. But if you do nothing about it, it is almost a given that by the time they hit adolescence or early adulthood, they will also carry a diagnosis of depression if somebody wants to diagnose them with it. Anxiety left untreated is one of the top predictors of depression. If we look, if we try and sort of untangle that a little bit, anxiety is about avoidance. It's about stepping back and stepping out. If you are a little person and you are anxious, it is perfectly appropriate for your parents to sort of be that crutch to make sure that you participate. If you are in a group of friends and you've got friends, you know who the little anxious kid is. We knew who it was in our group of friends, and we made sure that he was invited. He actually, our little anxious friend, had never slept over anybody's house before. And the mom says, so he's ready to have a sleepover. Can he have it at your house? Right? Sure, right? So I say, look, I can handle it. So he goes to sleep fine. I get up to go teach my spinning class at 5:30 in the morning, so I get up at 4:45. And I said to him, look, if you want to go home, you just have to tell me this is not the hill we're going to die on. So I get up at 4:45. He's standing in my son's bedroom door. He sees me coming down the hall. He goes, Lynn? I go, yeah? I'm ready to go home now. Hey, get the car! Drive it off on the way to the gym! There you go. Bye. Knock on the door. Hi, he's home. Yeah. If we don't do anything about it, After that kid hits middle school, it is no longer socially appropriate for parents to make sure that that child is included. It is no longer socially appropriate for you to get in the pool during swimming lessons. It's no longer socially... Go ahead, they're 18, you're in the pool, have at it. It's no longer... If there's a sleepover, it's no. You can't stay at the sleepover. So instead of the child participating with you there as the crutch, they won't. It's not T-ball anymore. It's trying out for a team. It's going to major league evaluations. It's standing up in front of people and having to take five pitches. I'm out. When they start avoiding things, what they miss out on, which is critical, is social connection. Middle schoolers need social connection. I say, when I talk to middle school teachers all the time, I say, look, we know that they're learning stuff, but what they're really learning is how to get along with people. They're learning how to participate in a group. They're learning how to be good losers and good winners. They're learning how to compromise. They're learning how to problem solve. They're learning how to manage difficult friendships and breakups and when mean girls treat them this way and how to not be a mean girl. When you are anxious, you are stepping out, stepping out, stepping out. If you don't have social connection when you are in high school, you are lonely and isolated. And a lonely, isolated teenager is almost guaranteed to become a depressed teenager. Developmentally, peer connection is critical at that stage. You don't have to have a lot of friends, but you have to feel like you fit in somewhere. And because anxiety says step out, step out, step out, it sets them up. School refusal in the name of anxiety is dangerous because they're not learning academically, but it is more dangerous emotionally because they are not engaging. And it's not because they don't want to. These are not kids that are homeschooled because they have chosen that as an option. These are kids who desperately wish that they could be involved but don't know how to do it. I had a boy socially anxious not going to school, and he said, when we started getting through this, he said to me, you know what really killed me when I wasn't going to school was that I knew I was funny. And my anxiety, my worry about what I was going to say didn't let people know that I was funny. And I was so mad at myself that I couldn't be funny. Because I knew if I could be funny, I could have friends. And, you know, we face it, and now he's got friends. And he is funny. And he's in a band. Yeah. So let's look at the overlap in cognitive patterns of anxiety and depression. There is a chunk of research going on right now with younger kids that says, why are we even calling this two different things? They are so predictive of each other. They hang out so much. Let's figure out how we can look at these common patterns and stop being so caught up in differentiating. What are the skills that these kids don't have, and what are the patterns that we see over and over again? These are the three that I see all the time. The global catastrophic permanent triad. The GCPs, I call it. If you talk to the kids that I treat, they will talk about the GCPs. I've got a great video of a kid explaining the GCPs that I can't show you guys because we made a deal I wouldn't show it in New Hampshire. Truly, he doesn't want, you know, one of you could be his school nurse, and he doesn't want that. So when I'm far away, I show it. But they get it. So global is you take a problem that's this big, and you get overwhelmed by it. So when somebody's being global, they use the word never, always, nobody, right? I always have bad luck. I'll never get this done. Nobody likes me. Overwhelmed. The opposite of being global is being compartmentalized, breaking things down into parts, and sequencing. So the projects that you do in fourth grade, right, if you've had a fourth grader in the Concord School District, you're probably all in New Hampshire, right? We have to do those. Remember those fourth grade projects of, what were they on? Like the famous person or something, right? Everybody, all parents dread them. They get overwhelmed by this big project. The goal is to break it down. The goal is to look at the parts. Compartmentalization means that you can be upset about something over here and put it aside for a moment so that you can handle what you have to do over here. People who are successful, people who cope, people who have good problem-solving strategies do that all the time. They break things into parts. The opposite of breaking things into parts is getting overwhelmed. When you get overwhelmed, I'm out. And there's that anxiety thing again. Can't do it. So global. The other thing is catastrophic. Catastrophic means you go to the worst-case scenario. People who worry are very catastrophic. They are under the impression that going to the worst case scenario helps them to prevent that from happening. Catastrophic parenting is a hallmark of passing anxiety down to your children. When you explain to them all the bad things that could happen, that's called catastrophic parenting, they see the world as a dangerous place. Kids who are raised with anxious parents perceive ambiguous situations as more dangerous than kids who are not raised by anxious parents. Catastrophic parenting is this. You give the important safety, and so you can't do catastrophic nursing either. You give the important safety information, right? I need you to get down from that tree, you're too high. And then you feel compelled to just add a little extra about what will happen if you don't follow the instructions. So, great example, there was a mom, and she was telling me that she was sort of confessing to me. So she had two little girls, 12 and 7. Let's say Ellie and Sam, their names are Ellie and Sam. Ellie and Sam are going to walk down to the store together that's near their house. So mom says to Ellie, Ellie, while you're with Sam, make sure you hold on to Sam's hand, because she's little, so hold on to her hand. Okay, that is a perfectly fine instruction. But then she had to say to Ellie, and let's just go over what might happen if you let go of Sam's hand. Right? There are people that will steal her. Do you understand that? There are people in the world that will steal her. You let go of her hand and she could be gone. We will never see her again. Right? Could you live with that information? Could you live knowing that you let go of her hand and she was gone? So let me stress again how important it is for you to hold on to her hand. And then she's like, off you go, right? And the two of them are like, right? Catastrophic parenting. So when you're catastrophic, you're going. Now, so here's a little tip. Here's a cognitive pattern, a cognitive technique, CBT thing, that I never use. And I'll say that globally. I never use. I never say to a kid, what's the worst that could happen? That is a very common cognitive technique. What's the worst that could happen? They go, now you're talking my language. Whenever you're doing something that imitates the anxiety disorder, I call that doing the disorder. If anxiety goes to the worst case scenario and freaks you out, then it is not therapeutic to imitate the disorder and go to the worst case scenario. If a kid is afraid of pooping on the bus, if a kid is afraid of throwing up in school, if a kid is afraid of embarrassing himself in front of his peers, and you say to the kid who's afraid to poop on the bus, so what's the worst that could happen? He's like, I could poop on the bus. Right? That's a dumb question. So we don't do that. We don't go catastrophic with them. Permanent is probably the thing at this point that is the most bothersome to me because it is becoming so common right now. This idea that things won't change in the mental health field has become sort of this way of saying, this is who you are, you have this disorder, this is the way you're wired, your depression or your anxiety is caused by a chemical balance, which, by the way, there is absolutely no definitive scientific evidence that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance. None. I know, isn't that shocking? It's true. No evidence to support that. It is a theory. We have a lot of chemicals going on in here, and at any given moment, we can be imbalanced. But to make a causal connection, the serotonin hypothesis has been dead in the water for over a decade. If you are raising a 14-year-old girl, doesn't she often have chemical imbalances? Yes, she does. 14-year-old boys, too. So this idea that things won't change, this idea that we can say to kids, under the guise of saying, we don't want to blame you for what you're dealing with, this is not your fault, which is a good message to give, but it is a very disempowering message when you say, this is going to be you for the rest of your life. I was recently talking to a girl who was doing a project for her high school, for her psych class. So she got my name, she called and said, can I interview you for my paper? Sure. So she calls, we're chatting on the phone, she's delightful, asking me all these questions, and then she says to me, which inevitably comes up when I'm talking to teenagers these days, so we learned in our psych class that when you get depression, that if you get it as a kid or a teenager, you will have to deal with that for the rest of your life because now you have depression and that's the way you're wired. It's wrong. It is so dangerous to give that message to kids. Please, please stop saying, if you've said it, that depression is like diabetes. Please, it's not. I hear it all the time. We're saying that to say, look, this is something we need to treat. It's something we need to deal with. And that's a good analogy. But to give kids the message that this is who they are, this is how they're wired, that they're going to carry this as a part of themselves, what I am seeing more and more, particularly in teenagers, is an embracing of this language. If you are nervous, you have an anxiety disorder. If you are sad, you are depressed. If you are in a bad mood, you're bipolar. If you're distracted, you have ADHD. We're not doing them a disservice by increasing their level of pathology in their own mind. It's not working. So when we when they did a study recently, and they told people who were suffering from depression two different things. Oh, I need my clicker. They told one group of people that their depression was chemical, a biochemical issue, and genetic. Those people were very pessimistic about their recovery. Why wouldn't they be? If I went to a physical therapist and my shoulder was hurt and I said, I can only move my shoulder like this, and she said, that's just how it's going to be, right? And then she gave me 10 exercises to do, I'd be like, no. She said, come back next week. Why bother? When a kid gets to why bother, we're in trouble. People who believe that depression and anxiety is caused by chemicals in genes don't do as well in terms of recovery. When people were told that your brain's chemistry and your genetic expression is malleable, those people were much more hopeful and optimistic about their recovery. If we are looking at what predicts success in terms of people getting over depression and anxiety and keeps them coming back for treatment, to be actively engaged in treatment, it is positive expectancy. When people believe that something will help, it helps. The placebo effect is enormously powerful in human beings. Anxiety, depression, pain, and sleep are very susceptible to placebos. And I am often a positive placebo. You are a positive placebo. You know it. You know it. You say, look, if I say to a kid, they're sitting there and go, oh, I go, oh my gosh, right? Let me just tell you right now, and I don't mean to say this in a way that doesn't make you feel special, but your anxiety is nothing worse than anything I've seen today. Right? So, and then a parent will come in and say, oh my gosh, you wouldn't believe, like, this is what she does, and it's so upsetting, blah, blah, blah. And I go, oh, yeah. She bites people? Yeah, that's my bread and butter. Yeah. She does this? Oh, yeah. All in a day's work. Come on in. Right away, they're like, what? She knows what she's talking about? Placebo. Positive expectancy. Get away from that permanent language. The more we talk about how things can change, how you're capable of rewiring your brain, neuroplasticity. If you get my newsletter, for those of you who get my newsletter, the little video that I sent out on neuroplasticity, did anybody see that? You're all looking at me blankly. Well, you should get my newsletter, and I'll tell you. So go on YouTube and just Google neuroplasticity. It comes up first for me because I've shown it to so many kids. But what you're looking for is this little 2-minute animated video put out by Sentis, S-E-N-T-I-S. That's how you know you're on the right thing. And the lady has this really charming Australian accent. I show it to kids all the time. If you can't find it, email me and I'll send you the link. I'll put it on Facebook tonight, if I remember. When we were looking, I always say we as if I'm doing this research. When people who do research were looking at some of the most genetically mediated traits that predict anxiety, the one that comes up and has come up for decades because of the work of Jerome Kagan is called behavioral inhibition. If you are behaviorally inhibited temperamentally, this means that even in infancy, things that are stimulating, things that are new, things that are different, overwhelm you. There are some babies that if you say, you want to come to me? They go, yeah, they'll go with anybody. There are some babies that have a strange face, right? You know those babies that give you the hairy eyeball? Right? You show them a new toy. Some babies go, oh. Other babies, oh. This is what we would call them very shy, right? These are the little kids that go to preschool and they're on your leg, right? And day 37, they're still on your leg. They stand back and watch. Behaviorally inhibited people have a much greater risk of developing anxiety disorders. So how do we intervene with a behaviorally inhibited child? We know that it's genetically mediated. We know that it's passed down. So there's an almost given, right, that you're going to have a behaviorally inhibited parent if it's a biological parent with that child. So they take monkeys, rhesus monkeys, that's a rhesus monkey, and they breed behaviorally inhibited rhesus monkeys. There's the joke, right? How do you breed behaviorally, right? Because they're like, no, you go, right? So they figured it out. They gave them time and privacy. They figured it out, and they create these behaviorally inhibited rhesus baby monkeys. They take the monkeys away from the behaviorally inhibited mom, which is mean and why we can't do it with humans, and they give it to what's called a supermom. This mom, this monkey, is not behaviorally inhibited, the opposite, extroverted, easygoing. And when that baby fusses and when that baby goes, the mom goes, oh, baby, rocks the baby, loves the baby, doesn't escalate with the baby, takes the baby wherever, you know, whatever rhesus monkeys do in their spare time. The behaviorally inhibited mom, right, has the same sort of temperament. So there's a loud noise and they both go, oh. So this mom loves this baby, models a different way of reacting to things, and by the time that baby hits monkey adolescence, they have nurtured the behaviorally inhibited temperament out of it. And they've done that with humans. Looking at that, they obviously, we don't breed them and take them away, but there are plenty of families where that just happens organically. And then they train the mom, they give the mom, they give the dad pointers about how to react differently. And the research is promising. The research is promising that even temperamentally, we can interrupt. We can change it. It's not a done deal. These pathways in our brain are far more malleable than they thought about even 10 years ago. Neuroplasticity, epigenetics, genes getting turned on and off. It's really fascinating stuff. So saying to a kid, this is just who you are, saying to a kid, you have depression, you're probably going to have to be on this medication for the rest of your life. This is something that you're always going to have to struggle with, is global, catastrophic, permanent language that cements something that's not helpful. And we do it in the name of being helpful and being caring and not wanting to blame, but we are getting in the way of the reality that active changing of thinking and behavior can rewire the brain. And that's what kids need to hear. They're not insulted by that. They're actually encouraged by it. If you want to read an interesting book, Jerome Kagan, who I referred to before, wrote The Human Spark in 2013. He's a psychologist out of Harvard who has been doing research on this kind of stuff, as I said, for decades. He's probably 85 now. He wrote this book. My fantasy is to write a book when I'm 83, because he says whatever he wants. That must be awesome. He just lays it out. So it's very interesting. It's a great perspective from somebody who's been in the field for a really long time. So what's the relationship between anxiety and depression in the future? So as I'm thinking about this, and in the last book that I wrote, I thought a lot. I was doing anxiety and depression and pain and sleep, and so I'm looking at the commonalities of these things. If you are depressed, the future is not a happy place because it's going to be just as miserable as it is today. Why should I bother to do anything tomorrow if it's going to feel as badly as it feels today? If you are anxious, the future is a scary place. I'm not going to go there. I can't handle it. Something might happen that I can't handle. Forget it. So the future is not a place that you're stepping toward. It's a place that you're retreating from. And that gets in the way because then we get withdrawal. If the future is uncertain, and in depression, we want to promote that the future is uncertain, because that's good news. In anxiety, we want to promote that the future is uncertain, because that's the reality and that's what they need to handle. Then the intervention becomes, I'm going to step into this unknown future. I'm not going to know exactly what to do, but I'm going to learn how to manage it. A child's relationship to their own future is really important for them to be able to step in and move forward. If you believe that the future is a scary place or a miserable place or a place in which you can't succeed, why bother? And when a kid gets to why bother, that's when we're in trouble. So it's not just about genes. It's about how children perceive the world, what they hear, what they learn, how they're allowed to figure things out, how they're allowed to develop their own autonomy. If we look at the connection between anxious parents and anxious kids, the research is more than robust. If you've seen me before, you know the answer to this question, so don't cheat. If we look at the percentage of kids who are living with an anxious parent, what percentage of those kids will develop an anxiety disorder by the time they reach young adulthood? How many of you think it's 0 to 30%? Good, I've knocked the optimism out of you. How many of you think 30 to 60%? Okay, all right, way to go. Way to hang in there. You're wrong. But I appreciate the can-do attitude. It's actually 65 to 70%. If you're an anxious parent, you are 6 to 7 times more likely to create an anxious child if you do nothing. So Golda Ginsburg did this great research. She was at Johns Hopkins. She has now since moved to UConn. She lives in Connecticut. What Golda wanted to figure out was that if we know 6 to 7 times more likely, if we're working with 65%, we've got a vulnerable population of kids with these anxious parents. And people had studied this with depression, they had studied it with substance abuse, but nobody had looked at this vulnerable population of kids to see if some kind of parental intervention would make a difference. So she found families where one or both of those parents had a diagnosable anxiety disorder, and the children were not yet showing signs of anxiety. They did not have anxiety yet. She brings them in. She divides them in half, of course. Control group, thanks for stopping by. Treatment group. She does 8 psychoeducational sessions with these parents, giving them information about catastrophic language, about developing independence, about how can we teach kids the skills, how can you model for them what they need in order to help them be depression-proof and anxiety-proof. She's looking at anxiety, but we know where it goes. So a year later, she has them come back, control group and treatment group. 8 psychoeducational sessions, 45 minutes to an hour. That's it. Not that complicated. In a group like this, giving parents information, making them more aware of their language, teaching them how to do things differently. After the first year, the control group, what percentage of these kids who had had no intervention, they were 0 at the beginning, were going to 65, how many of those kids had developed an anxiety disorder in the first year? 30. 30% of those kids were going to 65%, but 30% had already developed an anxiety disorder. The treatment group, how many of these kids would you think? Nobody gets 0. She got 0. This research got a lot of publicity in the anxiety world. This came out in 2010, right when Reed and I were in the middle of writing Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. Because we had decided, as clinicians, that we were going straight to the parents. And we weren't going to sugarcoat it. We were going to say, look, stop doing this and do this instead. We were going to stop being careful and saying, well, sometimes the things you do might... No. Look, it's not that complicated. So then this research came out, and it was very validating. She redid it in 2015. She had a larger group, and she got 5. This stayed about the same, and she got 5. 5 is still awesome. The only problem with 5 is that she got 0 the first time, so everybody's like, oh, no. 5 is awesome. Huge, huge, significant statistics when she did this kind of work. So the earlier that we intervene, the better. But these were kids between the ages of about 6 and 13, if I'm remembering correctly. So it's not too late. Being able to teach parents how to respond differently. So what happens when we're treating parents? What happens when we're treating anxious families? What happens when we're treating anxious kids and we don't help the parents? If we are looking, first of all, if you have to get anything in the mental health field, this is what you want to get, anxiety. Because look, 82%, 80% after you have treatment, no diagnosis. That's awesome. This is a really treatable thing. It's the most treatable thing in the mental health world, if you know what you're doing and you do it right. So if we have an anxious kid and we're treating them, and there's no parental anxiety, which happens every once in a while, but it's frankly pretty rare in my clinical practice. If we work with the kid, we get 82%. If we have some parent anxiety management with the parent, we're about the same statistically. Look what happens when we add the anxious parent in, and we only work with the kid. 39%, that's terrible. If we give the parent some anxiety management, if we give them some of the skills that are teachable and concrete and work, that rate goes back up to 77%. That's what we're looking for. In my practice, it makes no sense to me that I would work with a kid without the parents, except in the most extreme situations. Even with teenagers, the rule in my office is, if you can drive to your appointment by yourself, you can come by yourself. Otherwise, there's a parent in the waiting room. Now, maybe the parent stays in the waiting room if it's a teenager. If I'm working with a little kid, I'm seeing the parents as much, if not more, than the child. It makes no sense to me to work with an 8-year-old or a 7-year-old or a 12-year-old who's anxious, and I know the parents are anxious, and they are not part of the treatment. To drop your anxious child off at the therapist, have them go in, play for a while, and come back out doesn't teach you what you need to know as the anxious parent. And if we know over and over and again that anxious parents parent anxiously, why are we not paying attention to that? But I hear it all the time. Parents come in and I say, so I see you've been in previous treatment. What did you learn in the previous treatment? What were the goals? What were the homework assignments? I don't know. Well, what did your child do in treatment? Well, they just talked about what they were anxious about. That's called doing the disorder. Anxiety wants to talk about what it's anxious about. That's what anxiety does. Depression wants to talk about what's making you feel so bad. That's what depression does. If in the therapy you are actually doing the disorder, it's not going to help. Not going to help. So, now, my job is easier than your job, because when parents come to see me, they're ready to drink the Lynn Lyons Kool-Aid. They've made an appointment, they're writing me a check, they're looking for help. You're not in that enviable position. Nonetheless, I will tell you that it is very rare that if I'm dealing with the parent of an anxious child, particularly if it's an anxious parent, that they don't want helpful information. They want to know. They don't know what to do. And they are doing what they did, and they are also doing the things that are the most loving, caring, and supportive, and intuitive that they know how to do to help their child suffering. If you were an anxious kid and you went through school feeling terrified, and then you have this anxious kid, you know how it feels, you can empathize, you're going to protect that kid. You're going to do what you did, which was get out. And this is why we get a lot of pushback sometimes from anxious parents when we try and say, look, your child can stay in school, your child can tolerate this, because they don't know that that's going to work, and nobody's explained to them the importance of their child learning these skills. They feel their child's pain, and they want to protect their child. It happens all the time. You start giving parents the information, you start working with them, everybody's talking the same language. Very few parents are resistant to that. Every once in a while, we run up against it. But I'm not big at looking at, oh, the parents are sabotaging me on purpose, or, oh, they're secondary gain, all those psychobabble terms that we throw around. Every once in a while, you get one of those. But not most of the time. They just don't know what to do. So when you're working with parents, the psychoeducation piece is enormously helpful, so that they can understand and the kids can understand what this anxiety thing is about. If we move them away from the why and start teaching them the how, if we start making it concrete, if we start using skills, if we start presenting them to a way, in a way that doesn't sound scary and overwhelming but sounds very matter of fact, parents get on board. Yeah, they're either anxious, worn out, or both. They're trying to keep the train on the tracks. They're trying to get sleep. They're trying to get their kid to school. They're trying to get themselves to work. Anxiety in a family is enormously disruptive because it's all about avoidance. And it's also very dramatic. So it has a lot of somatic symptoms, as you know. It has vomiting and headaches and diarrhea and hives and all other sorts of symptoms. And so the more that the parents panic about what's wrong with their kid, the more that they're likely to circle the wagons and keep you back because you're saying the opposite of what they feel will help. They need to learn the same skills, and you need to be talking the same language. So I've told this story before, so if you've heard me speak before, you might have heard it. But Greta, who's heard me talk about my niece Greta? Anybody? Yeah, you've heard me. Okay, so Greta, just to give you updates so you can stay on abreast of what Greta's up to, Greta, starting tomorrow night, will be starring as Jane and Mary Poppins at the Flynn Theater in Burlington in a huge production of Mary Poppins, right? Yes, yeah, you're like, yay. Greta's very anxious, and I'm her aunt. So guess what I've been doing a lot of, right? My sister texts me and says, can you please just call Greta and check in and make sure she's doing okay? So Greta has been anxious for a long time. My sister is pretty anxious. My sister is a catastrophic parent. This is my sister's parenting philosophy. Right? Did you miss it? That's it. So when Greta was in first grade, she was having a hard time staying in the classroom. And so they let her skip gym, and then they let her skip music, and then they let her not eat in the cafeteria. And the deal was whenever she was feeling overwhelmed and worried, she could go to the guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor would give her a popsicle. Right? I know. So by April, Greta was averaging about 6 popsicles per day. My sister was okay with that. She didn't really know exactly what was going on, but then Greta refused to get on the bus to go to school. And that's when my sister drew the line, because my sister was like, now it's interfering with my life. So, luckily, after first grade, she was going to loop in second grade and have the same team teachers, which was enormously helpful. So I saw her over the summer a few times. Our family spent time together, and I worked with her on things. And then I was able to email the teachers, and we would have the same language. I said, this is what, when Greta says she's worried about this, this is what I want you to say. Day two, probably, Greta says, I can't go to the cafeteria. I can't handle it. And the teachers have been prompted to say to her, that's your worry talking, what are you going to say back? They said that like Greta's head spun around like she was in The Exorcist, you know, ah! Right? But within a week, everybody was talking the same language, right? We weren't putting Greta's worry in charge. Nobody was treating it like it was a catastrophe, very matter of fact. And Greta did really well in that second grade year. She continues to do really well. It's just things pop up. My sister, as we'll talk about later, my sister can't get out of the content. She always is sort of, when Greta says, I'm worried about this, my sister gets like, well, why are you worried about that? Greta called me the other night and said, I think I'm a racist. 2 months ago, she thought she was a lesbian. Now she thinks she's a racist. And she says, so I think I'm a racist. I go, well, you live in Vermont. How would you even know? She said, well, I don't think I'm a racist because I'm a nice person and I don't think badly of other people because of the color of their skin or whatever. She said, but somebody who's a racist probably doesn't think they're a racist. So maybe they think that the reason they think these things is because they're supposed to. So maybe I'm a racist. Maybe I'm one of those racists who doesn't know they're a racist. So I'm sure when she said to my sister, well, I'm sure when Greta said to my sister, I think I'm a racist, I'm sure my sister was like, where did you come up with that? What we need to do with Greta is say, oh, there's your worry talking again. And as Greta gets older, her worry just moves developmentally along the things that she's discovering. Last year, she discovered lesbians. This year, probably because of the political campaign, she's discovered racism. So that's what's on her mind, and that's what she's talking and thinking about. So here are the anxiety disorders. This is the diagnostic and statistical manual, which changes all the time, right? We put things in, we take things out. OCD and PTSD have been sort of pulled out a little bit into their own categories, probably rightfully so, although I treat OCD in a very similar way that I treat the other ones. The way that these diagnoses are differentiated is basically based on what you worry about. The content for separation anxiety, specific phobia, generalized anxiety disorder, social phobia, right? Those are all about what you worry about. And the way that I treat anxiety is that the content, what you're worried about, doesn't really matter very much. But that's where everybody gets stuck. And so when we start treating the anxiety disorder, and when we start trying to figure out what can we do to make it socially better, what can we do about this specific phobia about math, what can we do about this specific phobia about being in the cafeteria. I had one kid who was phobic of tuna fish sandwiches in the cafeteria. Every time he would see one, he would vomit. Right? I don't know why. There was no tuna trauma in his past. What we want to do, instead of focusing on the specific disorders, what we really want to do, what Reed would say, Reed, my co-host, he's from North Carolina, Reed Wilson, he would say, we want to chunk it up. Right? I don't know what that means. Right? I don't know what that means. Right? But apparently in North Carolina, people know what that means. We want to chunk it up. What he means is we want to come up to a process level. We want an overarching approach that deals with all the anxiety disorders rather than focusing on the content of each anxiety disorder. Because what happens is that when we start paying attention to the content, so when we have a content-based intervention, meaning that we are putting our focus on how do we change what's out here to make the child more capable of managing in school or anywhere else, we are doing the disorder. A process-based approach is about what is happening internally and doesn't focus on changing stuff out here. But you all work in schools. So how many 504 plans have you seen that are based on avoidance and changing the content? Probably every single one, because I've only seen four that haven't been, and they were written by my friend who writes good 504 plans. So when we focus on the content, when we focus on changing this out here, we lose the opportunity to address the process of anxiety. The process of anxiety is always the same, and this is it in a nutshell. It wants certainty and comfort. It wants to know everything, and it wants to feel comfortable. And if it can't have certainty, it seeks it, and it demands it, and it searches for it. So if there is an intervention for a child in a school that says he has a really hard time going from classroom to classroom, or he has a really hard time when he doesn't know what's coming next, so we're going to make sure that he is very much apprised of the schedule of the day. We are going to go over it with him so that he knows what's coming. The anxiety disorder says, thank you so much. I'm glad you're all on my team. Virtually every 504 that I have ever seen, it appears to me as if anxiety was invited to the meeting, told everybody what to write, and then high-fived everybody on the way out. What we need to do is we have to start looking at the skills that anxious kids need, and they need to be able to tolerate uncertainty and tolerate discomfort and know that they're going to get through it. The more that we seek to provide certainty, the more we are strengthening the anxious process. And because it's impossible to provide certainty, you're always playing catch up. If you've got a little kid in your office who's afraid of throwing up, they don't just come once and say, I'm afraid of throwing up. And you go, oh, well, you look fine. And then you see him again in April. No, no, no. They come in 8 times a day. They come in 5 times a week because their worry is saying, how do I know I'm not going to throw up? How do I know I'm not going to throw up? How do I know I'm not going to throw up? And the certainty that you try and provide doesn't stick. And it's all content-based. If you are taking their temperature to reassure them, if you are giving them saltines, if you are acting as if somehow you can provide certainty that they won't throw up, the anxiety is getting worse. If you've got a kid who's really going to throw up, right, you know the difference, don't you? You know your little frequent flyers. It's not hard for you guys to figure out. So when we're providing certainty, when we're trying to provide certainty, you are doing external reassurance, which is short-lived. You'll be fine. Now, this is hard a lot of times when I talk to school nurses because they're like, this is what we do, right? They come in, right? Are we supposed to provide reassurance? Absolutely, but not to kids who are chronically worried and anxious. When kids are somatic, when kids have physical symptoms that we know are based on anxiety, and you treat them like they are sick, you are reinforcing the anxiety disorder. The rule when I am working with kids is that if they are going to go to the nurse because they don't feel well and it's because of their anxiety, they cannot walk in and say, I have a tummy ache. They can walk in and say, Mrs. Smith, my worry is making my tummy hurt. I need some help with my worry. We have to help them identify what the issue is. Sometimes it takes a little while to get there. And we always want to get there. We don't want to assume. We don't want to make an assumption that the headache is because of stress or that the tummy ache, right? But I have plenty of kids who have been through years and years and years and years of physical tests. And there are diagnoses now which we know are shut the parent up diagnoses. Right? Functional abdominal pain. Doesn't that sound serious? Do you know what it means? You got an anxious tummy. We can't find anything wrong with your tummy. I just heard another one recently that I hadn't heard. I'm not going to be able to remember it now. It sounded very fancy. And I have a friend who's a pediatrician who specializes in somatic abdominal disorders, and I'm going to email him and go like, "What's is this the latest?" Yeah, it's very medical sounding. So what we want to do instead is, instead of working to create this certainty and comfort, when we do that, this is what we eliminate. We eliminate all these skills that we want kids to be able to handle. You have got to be able to tolerate ambiguity. You have got to be able to tolerate not knowing. How many people here have never, ever thrown up? Really? And is it because you are just strong-willed and you will not let the vomit come up? Because the only other person who's ever raised their hand was in Pittsburgh in 2012. So you are the second person. What? You've never thrown up? And is it a force of will for you two, or just it has never happened? What, in college? Almost once, yeah. All right, so, okay, well, you guys totally have blown my statistics. Now there are three people, one in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and two in Lebanon, New Hampshire, who have never thrown up. Okay, so besides you two outliers, right, the odds of a human being throwing up, besides these two, is 100%. So when we say to kids, you won't throw up, you'll be fine, you won't throw up, they don't believe us. And when we say to them, if you throw up in school, everyone will be respectful and it won't be embarrassing, that's also not true, right? Because it's going to be on the top of the headline news for 36 hours. That's how long it lasts until something else happens. If a kid throws up in school, when my kids were little, even now, they're a senior and a sophomore, if I say anything happened to school at school today that was interesting, if somebody puked, right? I mean, that is unbelievable news, right? Because there's mayhem. Jessica puked and it got on Amy's shoes, and then Amy freaked out, and then we all had to go out of the art room, and then the janitor had to come in and clean it up, and there was lasagna for lunch, and everybody's like, oh my God, Jessica threw up, Jessica threw up, and Jessica was crying, right? I mean, it's big news. It's so true. So when we say to kids, it'll be fine, you'll be fine, you're not going to throw up, if you throw up, it won't be embarrassing, they don't believe us. They want to. That's the external reassurance they're looking for, but it's short-lived because the worry is right there to come back in and say, oh, really? Really? Right? Somebody, you're afraid to fly? And you get on an airplane. If you are afraid to fly, the reason you're afraid to fly is because planes crash. They do. They go down. It's bad. Right? You want certainty. I'll get on that plane if you can guarantee me 100% that the plane won't crash. There's no guarantee. It happens rarely, but when it happens, it's a bummer. Right? I fly all the time and people say to me, well, you must not think about the plane crashing. I go, every time I get on the plane, the person goes, if the plane crashes. Right? That's what they're saying. Right? That's what they say. And then they give you that whole thing about the cushion. Right? This is going to save you. How many plane crashes do you see on TV and people are in the ocean holding their pillow, kicking? Right? Here we are. Never. Never. But it's certainty. So we're looking, you've got to be able to handle risk. You've got to be able to know. You've got to be able to know that there is risk. Did you have a question?
Well, about the vomiting. I think most of us nerds are pretty matter of fact.
Yeah.
The basket.
Uh-huh.
Let me know when you
move
on or something. But scenario, just tell us, what should we be saying?
Right. So if you know it's a frequent flyer, mm-hmm. right? So we'll get to that. But what you should be saying is, okay, so here's your worry. And your worry is making your tummy feel upset. And they will take offense if you think that they're faking, right? So I always say, look, if you are anxious and you are worried and you vomit, it is not pretend vomit. It is real. It is not magic fairy dust vomit. It's real vomit. This is real. But when you come in here and you are feeling worried and your tummy hurts, we will talk about your worry. Because that's the source of the problem. And then we'll get to what you say about that. But what I would say, if you came in and said, and I knew you were one of my little frequent flyers, and you said, I have a tummy ache, I would say, now, let's talk about your worry. And then we'd say, we take the worry out, right? So worry is named Sylvia, so you and I would have a conversation with Sylvia. And there would be an index card, or on Martha's Vineyard, apparently it's all on a computer, right? So call up the child, and there would be an index card, and you would practice talking back to the worry with the child. So the intervention would be, how are we going to talk to the worry, rather than pretend that you have some sort of physical illness, which we know is worry. I had a little kid who was a frequent flyer, and she would go into the she would go into the nurse all the time, all the time, all the time. And she said to me, one of these days I'm going to be sick, and I will show you, right? Well, she was sick, so she goes into the office, and the nurse says, oh, you're back again, right? And she goes, I really feel sick. And they were like, oh, there's your worry, go back to class. She's like, no, I'm really sick. Oh, back to class. She goes back to class. Within a half an hour, the teacher was like, oh, she really is sick. She came back in, they took her temperature, she had a fever, she ended up having strep throat or something. She came into the next session, she was so mad at me. I said, that was going to happen eventually. But what did you learn from it? It took everybody in your school a half an hour to figure out that you were really sick. And that's, I'm willing to spend that half an hour of you feeling lousy in your classroom if we can help you deal with your worry. That's a trade I'm willing to make. She was like, oh. She was so mad. So when we're, yes.
So how do you get the child to recognize that there is a worry?
It's coming.
Oh. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. This is what we want to talk to kids about. First of all, we want to know, we want to teach them the physiological process of this anxiety thing. Not only is it kind of interesting, they like this information, but it gives you a common language to talk to. So I'm going to explain to you exactly how I explain it to kids. Then we want to deal with the cognitive stuff. And when I'm working with anxious kids, there are three beliefs, three principles that guide my work. One I've already alluded to. The content is not as important as the process. If we talk about the content, if we get into the content, if they come in and say, I'm worried about my math test, and you start talking about the math test. If they say, I'm worried that when I go into the cafeteria, somebody's going to be mean to me, and you start talking about how the kids in your class aren't that mean, and the last time that you were worried about this, you went to the cafeteria and nobody was mean, that's a content-based intervention. So we're going to take a step back. I'm going to show you how to do it in a minute. We are eliminating nothing. This is an important thing, because when it comes to anxiety, there is a lot of focus on getting rid of symptoms. There's a lot of focus on calming down, feeling better, right? Placebos, get rid of the symptoms. That's not a message I want to give kids. Because anxiety is all about trying to get rid of stuff. It's all about, oh, I feel this and I need to get rid of it. I'm experiencing this, I need to avoid it. What I need them to do is to be on offense. That means they're going to step in to the things that are making them worried and learn how to manage them. That's how we're going to create these new neural pathways. That's how we're going to make progress through this thing. If we focus on getting rid of worry symptoms, either worried thoughts, worried feelings, worrying sensations, you are doing this order and you're just going to be stuck in it. So how do we do that? Well, I just said that. So, step one, you're going to have a thought, a feeling, a sensation. We're just going to accept that. Right? We're human beings. These are busy places. We think things. Who didn't come home from the hospital with their new baby and stand at the top of the steps and have the thought, oh my God, if I fell down the stairs, I would crush my baby? Right? We have those thoughts. It's normal to have those thoughts, normal to have those feelings and those sensations. We are not trying to get rid of them. We are changing your relationship to them when they show up. If you are a chronic worrier, and even if you're just a normal human being, you're going to have worries when things are uncertain or uncomfortable, when you're stepping into a situation and you're not sure how it's going to go. And school is all about stepping into situations where you're not sure how it's going to go, because that's what learning is about. That's what growing is about. So let me show you this video. Some of you, if you've seen me before, you've seen Burger and Fries. So this is Burger and Fries. We'll watch this and then we'll discuss. Whoop, come back. There's no sound. You can hear it a little bit. All right, so he's going like it, really loudly. You can hear it a little bit. So if the sound were on, it would be really loud. And that's Burger and Fries, and he's really doing his thing. Yeah, you're right, whoever said he's never going home. That wasn't very nice. You're not a cat person. He just needs love. So, but this is what anxiety brings with it. Right? It brings screaming and temper tantrums and biting. And you all know, right? It's got vomiting and diarrhea and headaches and hives and skin eruptions and eczema. It's just this really wonderfully physically messy thing, an emotionally messy thing. And when it shows up, if everybody's trying to get rid of it, if we as providers are uncomfortable with it and we don't see through the drama to what's behind it, then we get caught in the trap too of trying to calm everything down. We lose track of the process behind this because the process is so predictable. It's not complicated. Anxiety is not complicated. Here's anxiety in a nutshell. Blah, 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 and you can't handle it. That's it. That's it. That's all it's got. Over and over and over again. Any content we can put in there. You're going to take a test and get a bad grade and you can't handle it. You're going to poop on the bus and you can't handle it. You're going to be talking to somebody and some spit is going to come out of your mouth and land on their nose and you can't handle it. You're going to go into the cafeteria and it's going to be too loud and you can't handle it. You're going to be playing dodgeball and somebody's going to cheat and it's going to make you mad and you can't handle it. Anxiety is about rigidity. We have to follow the rules. Things have to go the way they have to go. Flexibility. So what do we do instead? Well, first of all, here's what we do. First, we're going to explain to kids how this anxiety thing works. Right? So, got to roll up my sleeves. I'm hot. I want to take off my shirt, but that would be inappropriate. All right. So, prefrontal cortex, this is where we think, this is our sophisticated part, this is where we solve problems, this is where we contemplate the future. This is what makes us worry, it also is what makes us on the top of the food chain. Human beings have the ability to contemplate the future. Cats don't. Chipmunks don't. They live in the moment, something happens, oh, then they move to the next moment. We what if. The calling card of anxiety is what if. What if, what if, what if. So you have a worry about something. Oh my gosh, standardized testing. Right? In Massachusetts, two days ago, they started the MCAS testing. I know that because I saw somebody who lives in Massachusetts. Right? So standardized testing. We're going to have this testing. Oh no, oh no, oh no. One little third grader told me, they send those tests to your college, he said to me. Okay, right, I don't know who told you that. Right? Yeah. All right, so worry, 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 worry. What if? You imagine, remember that catastrophic, go to the worst case scenario. Grabs onto your imagination. Here we go, right? I'm imagining. This is exactly how I talk to kids about it. Prefrontal cortex, worry. Sends a message to another part of your brain. You have another part of your brain in here, your amygdala. If we drilled through your brain, we would hit it. Amygdala means almond. It's about this big, the shape of an almond. You've actually got a pair of them in there. 500 million years old. Much, much older than human beings. Chipmunks have it. Cats have it. Giraffes have it. When that prefrontal cortex sends a danger message to the amygdala, because it is so primitive, but so loyal and so dependable, does not have the ability to say, oh, for Pete's sake, it's just standardized testing. Look, it's going to be gone in a few years, right? Don't get tired about it. It doesn't have the ability to say that. When it gets a danger message, it reacts. Sends a message, boom, down to your adrenal glands. From your adrenal glands, we shoot norepinephrine. That's this stuff, norepinephrine. You kids know it as adrenaline. Norepinephrine through your system, little spray bottles. Goes through your body, sends messages to your body. Getting you ready for danger! Right? This amygdala doesn't know the difference between real and imagined danger. If you are worrying about something and thinking about something, you are sending a danger message to your amygdala, an oh no message, an uh-oh message. The amygdala goes to work. Boom! Oh, my girl's in trouble! Quick! First of all, we've got to get blood and oxygen to these big running away muscles. So we're going to increase your heart rate. Boom, boom, boom. We're going to increase your breathing a little bit. And first we're going to freeze because you've got to hold your breath. Right? And then you're going to start breathing. Oxygen, blood, big running away muscles. We are going to shut down your digestive system. That's interesting. Kids are very interested to learn that piece of information. It is no longer necessary to digest your bagel and cream cheese if you're about to be eaten by a grizzly bear. So we're going to cease operations here. We're going to send that energy out. We might get rid of the blood out in your very extremities out here because people don't run away on their fingertips. So we're trying to conserve, get all this energy to where we need it. We're going to dilate your pupils a little bit so that you can see the danger. We're going to even throw a little extra blood clotting stuff into your system. In case a grizzly bear rips off your arm, maybe you won't bleed out, right? It's very, very cool. But the problem is, this happens whether you need it or not. If you are really in danger, it's fabulous. If you are contemplating a spelling test, thinking about pooping on the bus, wondering whether or not you're going to be able to handle what happens when they start playing Stairway to Heaven at the end of the middle school dance. That comes up a lot, actually. And I will say to them, look, it'll be weird, right? Because the song will be fast, and then it'll be slow, and it'll be awkward, and like your mom maybe is at the door because they know the dance. It's going to be bad. I go, when Stairway to Heaven happens, right? Really, woo, right? Everybody's amygdala is going to be firing off, and you're supposed to dance, yeah. I say to kids, that's a wash. That's just a wash, right? All right, so worry. Can't tell the difference. So now your body's all fired up. This is energy. Little spray bottles of energy. And your body has this energy, and it's designed to burn it off. But you're not going to burn it off because you're just sitting there. And you're thinking. And you're contemplating. Or maybe you're freaking out, right? There's the fight. There's the burger and fries. And it feels out of control. So what we have to do is we have to figure out how to interrupt right here. When those worried thoughts show up, we got to stop firing off the amygdala. And that takes practice. The amygdala, the more it gets fired off, the more it fires off. So it develops a little bit of a hair trigger. So if you got a chronic worrier, right, think about people who are in traumatic situations, abusive situations, in war zones, that amygdala learns, danger, danger, danger. We take them out of the situation, we put them in somewhere where it's not dangerous, and that amygdala is primed. So you have to rework it. So once kids begin to understand, prefrontal cortex activates your amygdala, fires off your adrenal glands, little norepinephrine. They like these words. They like understanding this. And then when a kid comes in and is all fired up, right? You go, oh my gosh, get a little, right? So how'd your prefrontal cortex set off your amygdala? What do you think? How'd your worry get you going? And right there, now you have a conversation about it. One little girl called it her Amy G. Dalla. Isn't that cute? She wanted to have it removed. She asked me if she could have it removed. She said, if I just got rid of my Amy G. Dalla, then wouldn't that solve the problem? I go, well, when you need it, you really need it. We want to keep it in there, right? Because you'll be up on the roof in a shopping basket trying to go into the pool. So we came up with seven steps. Reed and I came up with seven steps. We made it into a puzzle because it looked nice in the... Publisher said that was nice. It could have been anything. But the first one, expect to worry. Of course you're going to worry. The two words, of course, I couldn't live without the words of course. Being a therapist who specializes in anxiety and worry. Of course you're going to feel worried. Of course you're going to feel anxious. Because you're stepping into new territory. So that's what school does, right? You go into first grade and it's a little new and you don't know your teacher and you figure it all out and you learn that, you know, math is going to be at this time and lunch is at this time. We're going to go to gym here and then you're going to figure out that you actually can do subtraction. You're going to start feeling good. And then as soon as you figure it all out, we go, yay, end of the school year. Now we get to do it all over again. Kids are generally more anxious. Worriers worry more in May and June than they do in September. Huh, you say. Here's my theory. A, in May and June, they're tired. They don't know what's going to happen, but it's a far way off. As soon as teachers start taking the stuff down off their walls, they freak out. Because they've settled in, they figured it out, and now it's time to step into uncertainty again. And the anticipation of that freaks them out. And we've got all this talk about, well, now you're moving up, right? Move up day for worried kids. That's freak out day, right? Uncertainty day, because now they're so worried about it. And they don't have enough information to sink their teeth into, so they're just swimming around in uncertainty. So the summer is hard for them. Yeah, so we're going to expect to worry. It's normal. Of course worry is going to show up. Right? It's not about getting rid of these thoughts. It's not about stopping these thoughts. It's about reacting and responding differently to them when they show up. When is worry going to show up? When you're doing something new, when you're learning something, when you feel uncertain, when you're being judged. Right? And kids with social issues will say, I don't want to be judged. Well, sorry, that's what human beings do. That's what social animals do. When two wolves meet each other, they size each other up. When dogs meet each other, right? Who's bigger? Who's stronger? Who can I mate with, right? Who's part of my pack? Who's not? I had this one little girl come in. So she always talks to me about she just doesn't want to be judged. She's so worried about being judged. And she came to see me 2 weeks ago, and she sat down, and she goes, how come you always wear the same pants? Every time I see you, you're always wearing the same pants. Which is not true. I have several pairs of black pants. And I said, well, see, that's what human beings do. Right? You walked in and you observed me and you came to some conclusions. You judged me. Unfairly, I might add, but you judged me. Right? So that's okay. So of course people are going to judge you just like you judged me. That's all right. That's what human beings do. Because we got to pay attention to each other in order to survive. We're social. You can send kids to research other social animals and have them look online. YouTube has so many great videos of how animals judge each other. Right? What do they do? It's a part of being a social animal. Of course. How about when you want to do something well, when you want to pass a test, when you want to get your driver's license, when you put yourself out there, when you ask somebody on a date, when you go to the dance for the first time? Of course you're going to feel worried because the outcome is uncertain and it feels uncomfortable. So normal, normal, normal. Then what do? We're going to take that worry out and we're going to talk to it. We're going to have a conversation with it. For younger kids, they will totally get into drawing a picture of it, giving it a name, making it into a character. For older kids, same deal. Adults, I do the same thing. We just bump our language up. So instead of saying to the second grader, all right, so let's figure out what your worry is going to look like. Oh, my gosh. Oh, it's a monster. Oh, it's a little, you know, ball of bubble gum with a face. Right? I just say to the middle schooler, all right, look, you've got a part of you that worries. It's a pattern. It's very helpful if we can pull out that pattern and have a look at it so you can recognize it. So let's pull it out and let's have a look at it. For the sake of communication, let's give it a name so that it's out here. It's a part of you, but let's just put it out here, right? That's how we do with older kids, Right? So they name their worry Fred. They name their worry Sylvia. Yeah.
What about adolescents?
Same deal. Yeah. I mean, grown-ups I do this with.
And you have them name it and everything?
Sure. I mean, I don't go like, I go, look, I'll say, for the sake of you know, communication, let's just give it a name. What do you want to name it? And I will say to them, who's the most annoying kid in your grade who says things who you roll your eyes at and ignore? And they go, oh, yeah, Brendan or what, Adam, right? Okay, so let's name your worry Adam. When it shows up, that's what we're going to do. We're going to roll our eyes and ignore it, right? Just because you think it doesn't make it so. Don't believe everything you hear. Don't believe everything you think. Yeah, I just talk to them in a more sophisticated way. Yeah, well, yeah, let's just pull this part out of you. And with anxious families, I will have the anxious parent pull the part out and give it a name. And then tell the kids, look, so your worry is named Bob. Your mom's worry is named Sylvia. When Sylvia's bossing you guys around, tell your mom that you've had it with Sylvia. And they're very happy to do that. But what you're modeling for them is that I can get some distance from this thinking pattern. That's why we don't say this is just who you are. This is a thinking pattern. And once they begin to recognize it, if I have kids with OCD, and I was asking a kid the other day, do you recognize when you have an OCD thought, do you recognize the quality of that thought? Yes, I do. She recognizes it. She's 13 years old. She knows when that's an OCD thought. Might be hard for her to disengage with it. She's still working on that. But she recognizes the quality of that. Pull it out. Do it with adults. OCD treatment's all about pulling it out and having a look at it. And if they don't want to call it their worry, if they resist that, right, you can call it their anger. You can call it their bossy part. You can call it their rigid part, right, their uncooked piece of spaghetti. Get a box of spaghetti and have it in your office. And when worriers come in, give them the piece of uncooked spaghetti and ask them to tie it in a knot. And what will happen, it will break into pieces. And you say, this is what your worry does to you. Your worry makes all these rules that you have to follow. So it makes it rigid, it makes you rigid, and it makes you fragile. So we need you to be cooked spaghetti, not uncooked spaghetti. They like that visual. So we're going to talk to it, we're going to externalize it, and we're going to talk to the worry about what the worry does, not about what the worry is worrying about. Because it's the same thing. I will play a game with kids. I will say, okay, so let's pretend, come up with something ridiculous that nobody would worry about. Oh, I'm worried about marshmallows. And let's talk this through as if you have a fear of marshmallows. Get it out of the content. With OCD in particular, the content never matters. And the thing about OCD, particularly if it's intrusive thought OCD, if it's intrusive, somebody's beeper, if it's intrusive thought OCD, those thoughts are disturbing, often violent, disturbing to the child. If you get caught up in the content of those thoughts, if you don't recognize intrusive thought OCD, then you will overreact. So somebody who has an intrusive thought that maybe they're going to drink the hydrogen peroxide while they're cleaning out their newly pierced ears, that kid is not suicidal. They have a part of them that says, what if? It's this fear, this thought that pops up that says, you might do this. And then it says, maybe you did do this. You will recognize it in kids who worry that they cheated, worry that they lied. Worry that they didn't tell you everything. There is a confessional that goes with it. If a child comes to you and says, I have this thought, I'm worried that I'm going to take the scissors and stab my teacher. If they are distressed by that thought, and if you ask them, have you had other thoughts like this before that you might do something that you know you don't want to do, they will say yes. They're not homicidal. Greta, I think, is developing this because she's worried that she's a racist. She needs to call and confess it to me. That one of the very common things that happens with this kind of OCD is worrying about whether you're gay or straight. Guess when that shows up? Adolescence. Yeah. So paying attention. If you get caught into the content, If somebody comes to you and says, I'm afraid that I'm going to cheat on my test, and you say to them, you would never cheat. That's what they want you to say. They're looking, that's part of the OCD ritual. I will confess it to you and you will give me reassurance that I didn't do it. Look for that. People think about OCD as checking and counting and hand washing. This other OCD, which is often misdiagnosed and missed by people for a really long time, is incredibly debilitating. I'm worried that I'm going to sin. I'm worried that I'm going to do something. I'm worried that this impulse that I have, right? And that's a normal thing. Have you ever been driving down the road and you think, like, gosh, some people, you could go like this. I remember standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon with its 4-foot or like 3-foot thing. And I was thinking, God, somebody could just jump, right? And I think, what would that feel like to just jump right now? Like, oh, my God, that's weird, Lynn. Don't do that. Right? But think about if you had those thoughts all the time. And they're violent and disturbing. I'm worried that I'm going to kill my mother. I'm worried that I'm going to cut off my hands with knives. I'm worried that I'm going to, right? They're not suicidal or homicidal because they are distressed by this thought. So you want to pay attention to that. So content, right? So here's the, oh, I hate shots. I can't do this. I need to leave now. And versus saying, oh, that's my normal worry talking. That's what my worry does. When we pull OCD out and identify it, when we pull worry out and identify it, there is an enormous amount of relief when you begin to talk about this part of them and you separate it out. They feel relieved. And parents feel very relieved. This is just to make sure that I have hammered home the content versus process conversation. So if we're talking about content, this is what we're doing. We're going over plans. We're giving you more information. We're creating certainty. We're giving you all the statistics on how often planes crash. We're giving you all the statistics on Ebola. What happens if it's an unanswerable question? A woman came to see me and she said, I'm really worried about what's going to happen to me after I die. I was like, yeah, okay. She's like, well, I want you to tell me. I don't know. She said, well, just come up with something. Tell me what you think, and I'll believe what you think. I go, oh, you don't want to know what I think. Ebola, remember Ebola? That was good for business. It's gone now. Remember the guy that the world was going to end? Remember December 21st? We were all going to be sucked up. Well, the good people were going to be sucked up. The rest of us were going to just stay down here and suffer. That was good for business. And December 21st, done, gone. Never haven't seen him since. They'll find something else. It's just content, content, content. You're not going to throw up. You'll be fine. You're not mean. You didn't cheat. A common OCD intrusive thought is that you ran over a body with your car. Anything goes with this thing. Anything goes. Yeah. So providing content reassurance doesn't do anything. We've got to interrupt the process. This is how we interrupt the process. That sounds like your worry to me. Oh, you're here, you have a tummy ache. Ah, sounds like your worry's up to something. What are we going to talk to? How are we going to talk back to your worry? The place that people get stuck with worry sometimes, and parents ask me this all the time, surprisingly after I talk to them for 2 hours about that the content doesn't matter, they will come up at the end and they will say, the problem is, this seems very helpful if, you know, your kid is afraid of dogs or afraid of thunderstorms, but we don't know what our child is worried about. Right? And usually it's 9 o'clock and I've been talking 2 hours and I want to go like, really? Oh, for the love of Pete, right? It doesn't matter. But when we get caught in that, we have to know it doesn't matter. They don't have to know. And it jumps around. If you have generalized anxiety disorder, anything goes. Whatever crosses your screen, you grab onto. Whatever you happen to hear. I had a little boy who was worried that he was going to start smoking because he heard his older brother talking about smoking. Then the neighbor across the street got addicted to heroin. So then he was worried that maybe he would get addicted to heroin. Then he heard his older brother talking about blowjobs. Right? And that threw him. How do I know? How does that happen? Right? When does that happen? Who would do that? Right? And then he was reading a book on for middle school on suicide. And he had never really heard of suicide before. What happens if I want to commit suicide? Why do people do that? Just go, boom, 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 boom. So by the time, probably by the time we hit blowjobs, he had figured this out. So he would say, oh, it's just content. It's just content. And we would say, oh, I wonder what the next content is going to be. I wonder what the worry is going to grab onto. I wonder what's going to get its attention. And kids will come in and say, oh, you wouldn't believe what my worry is worrying about now. And they'll tell me, and I'll say, well played, worry. Right? Oh, that was a good one. I'll say, oh, I've never heard that one before. Oh, yeah, that's right on time. Wait, are you 12 and a half? Yeah, there we go. When kids find out that their parents have sex and their worries, freaks them out. I had one little girl, and she became determined to not let that happen again. And she was camping outside the parents' door, and the dad said, we can't even roll over. She comes busting in, and then he says to me, believe me, we're not. Because if you had this watching you, you wouldn't even try. It's very developmental. It's very predictable. What do you think a kid came and talked to me about this week? What's going on in the world?
Trump.
Well, right, some people are worried about Trump. Terrorists. Yeah, ISIS. So he goes to school, and the school bus driver, who knows his mom, calls his mom, and they know, you know, he's got an IEP, and he's got a lot of worry, and they're working on it. And the school bus driver calls the mom and says, I just want you to know that I got interrogated on the way to school this morning about ISIS. So that's in the fry pan right now. Uncertainty. And so what do you say to that? Oh, everything's fine? Nothing's going to happen? You can't do that. That's content. We want to reassure. We got to say, I know, it's so hard to live with this uncertainty, isn't it? It's so hard to not know. What are you going to say to your worry? When your worry shows up and says maybe you shouldn't go to school because of ISIS, what would you like to say back to your worry? Worry, I understand you're worried about ISIS because it's uncertain and uncomfortable. I'm not going to put you in charge of me. If it's a real worry, then we problem solve. Right? I'm worried that. You know, it's flu season, so you want to wash your hands. You don't have to wash your hands 20 times a day. So being able to help kids discriminate between, is this a real worry that I need to problem solve, or is this my worry part, jabber, 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 jabber. People who worry don't know the difference between those two things. When they worry, it feels like problem solving. They don't know the difference. They go over it and over it and over it and over it. That's why, again, if you are in treatment for anxiety and what you do when you go to see your therapist is talk about what you worry about, you are doing the disorder. That's what it wants to do. We've got to interrupt that pattern of perseverating and treating the content as if it's meaningful. Oh, that's this. I just said that. I stole this slide. This is Reed's slide. I stole it from him. So, when we're going to be on offense, we got to be unsure and uncomfortable on purpose. Why would we do it on purpose, kids say? Why would I purposely do it? Because my goal is to not feel these things. My goal is to step out. Why in the world, if I'm afraid of snakes, would I go hold snakes? Why in the world, if I'm terrified of flying, would I fly? Why, if I'm medically phobic like I was, why would I talk to people about gross medical things? Because my job is to retrain my brain. My first job out of graduate school was in a hospital, which is where they keep all the medical stuff. And I had huge, horrible phobia of anything remotely related to medical stuff. And I would have a full-blown panic attack. Big vasovagal reaction, blah, faint. It was terrible and messy. Sometimes I would throw up. I've only done it twice in 17 years. Both were very fairly public and humiliating. But so why? What do I do? What do? We keep stepping in. If worry says stop, you can't do it. And if the goal is to create new pathways, if the goal is to have an experience that allows you to see that you can manage uncertainty and manage discomfort, you got to get into the uncertainty and into the discomfort. And if you do it on purpose, all the better, because the prefrontal cortex then doesn't send that danger message to the amygdala. If you are afraid of dogs, and you're going to do your exposure work, so let's pretend that there's a dog sitting there, right? So you all know what exposure is, right? It's exposure therapy. So there's the dog. Okay, so I'm going to go near the dog. Oh, gosh, I'm feeling... All right, I better step back. Oh, better calm myself down. Can't feel this way. Can't feel... Okay, so maybe, like, in 10 years, you're going to get close to the dog. If you say, all right, let's go, bring it on, right? On offense, not defense. The amygdala is going to be saying, like, hey, wait a second, didn't you train me? Dogs are dangerous. Yeah, but we got a new program. Worry lives here. We give it something else to think about. It's okay if we fake it. I'm going in. Let's go. I'm moving toward this. I'm going to get close enough to the dog. I'm going to stay near the dog. My amygdala is going to go, huh? I might get a little, that's okay. And I'm going to survive. I'm going to be okay. When I go to give blood, I can say this sometimes when I'm telling people this, I can see people in the audience are like, don't say this, but you're all nurses. So when I go to give blood, which I would never do when I was a kid, I fainted when I got a blister frozen off this finger. I mean, not a blister, a wart. Right? They put, what's that cold stuff? Yeah, it made a blister. And I passed out. Because I was in a doctor's office. And I was sending danger messages to my amygdala. And my amygdala didn't have the ability to say, oh my God, Lynn, it's a blister. I passed out. My poor mother, she'd be like, oh my God. Again, she would get calls. Oh, we found Lynn on the bathroom floor. So I go to give blood. I could go in. And I could be on defense, and I could say, all right, so I'm happy to give blood, but I'm one of those people who faint, so you might want to tilt my head down. And yeah, no, I go in on offense. Let's go. I don't say anything to them. They're taking my blood. The lady says, if this is the time when you want, some people like to look away. I go, oh, no, I want to watch. My worry goes, what? I'm watching. So I'm doing this, right? And then I'm looking over at the other lady's bag. And her bag is filling up very quickly, and my bag is filling up very slowly. So I say, hey, how come her bag is filling up so quickly? I'm getting curious. I'm asking questions. This is the opposite of me retreating. And she says, well, I don't know, maybe she's better hydrated than you. And I say, and she says, if your bag doesn't fill up in 20 minutes, we have to throw it away. I go, oh, like hell, you're going to throw it away? Right? This is like an hour and a half out of my day. This is good blood. And I said, so I said, well, what can I do to speed it up? She goes, well, just squeeze and release, squeeze and release. Right? So I sit there, squeeze, and then I go, hey, look, my bag is filling up faster. And she says to me, have you turned giving blood into some sort of competition? Yeah, because I can talk that language. That's the opposite. That's being on offense. Bring it on. Let's go. I have a friend who's a medical malpractice attorney. When I see him, I say, hey, tell me about the latest case that you're working on. Because medical malpractice attorneys, that's the most disgusting stuff there is, right? Things went wrong. So he starts telling me, my worry goes, well, don't ask Jonathan that. Let's go. We got to be on offense. So when we help kids avoid, when we create safe escapes, when we take them out, when we don't give them the opportunity to tolerate and experience and relearn, we're getting in the way. And you've got to get them to buy in. This is the message that I want them to have. If they're uncomfortable or anxious, they're on the right track because it means their brain is relearning. Worry takes away territory. It makes your world smaller. We're going to make your world bigger. And as we do that, you're going to feel anxious and you're going to feel overwhelmed. They won't do this unless they have some understanding of why we're doing it. It has to be front-loaded. You can't just say to a kid, from now on, you have to go to gym, without doing the front-loading that says, this is why we're doing it. We're retraining your amygdala. We're getting out of the content and we're going into the process. We're getting you on offense. I was talking to a little kid about being afraid of elevators. He wasn't afraid of elevators. We were using it as an example. So I said, if we were on defense, we had to go in an elevator. If we were on defense, how would we act? Well, he said, we'd go in, ooh, it's so scary to be in this elevator. We'd imagine terrible things. Ah, we'd hope, oh, gosh, we'd close our eyes. I said, if we were on offense, if we're trying to retrain the amygdala, and this person is going to get into the elevator. She works on a 38th floor. She's got to learn how to get on the elevator, and she's going to bring it on, right? So what can we do? What would be the assignment we would give her if she was on offense? And without missing a beat, he said, we would press every single button in the elevator. Right? That's exactly right. And having a kid enter into school 10 minutes of the day, then 20 minutes the next day, then 30 minutes the next day, then 40 minutes the next day doesn't work. It doesn't work. See, I love you guys, because sometimes parents are like, what? You guys are like, I know. It doesn't give you time to acclimate, right? You got to get in, feel the anxiety, hang out. Huh, I'm doing okay. How many times have you seen that happen? Once they get in the building, they're okay. Once they get through it, they're okay. Got to get them in the building. Yes?
But then you get calls from the parent, this year especially, a parent called and said, have you seen Johnny? Because I got a phone call and they hung up. I'm wondering, did they come see him? I'm like, no, didn't see Johnny. That's good. I mean, then I'll get another
That's
call.
Right.
Like, I want to say, get a life. What, are you working?
Yeah.
Waiting by the phone for their child to...
Anxious children shouldn't be able to contact their parents during the school day. That's very hard for parents to accept, because that's the crutch. Cell phones are a dream come true for anxiety disorders, because now not only can the parents keep track of the kids can keep track of the parents. Mm-hmm. So you can go to the bus stop by yourself, but you have to text me when you get off the on the bus. You have to text me when you get off the bus. Right? Anxious kids like to keep track of parents. Right? So I'll be home at 7. Well, what happens when it gets to be 7:05? You start getting texts. Where are you? Because I need the certainty. I need you to show up when you said you were going to show up. My worry says you have to be here. So those would be things that I would put in the 504. Because remember, you can put anything you want in a 504. It just can't require new services. You guys can do, because this is your job, it's not new services, you guys are there. This is what you do. That's why having a nurse component to an anxiety 504 is critical. Because this is your job. And you can put in the 504 that if mom calls the nurse to check on the child, the nurse is not going to have contact with the kid. The nurse is not going to facilitate that. If the child comes into the nurse's office, the nurse is not going to call the parent, if that's an appropriate, intervention for it. But you guys can put whatever you want in 504s for anxiety, because it doesn't require new services of you. This is your job. So you guys are really powerful in this. How many of you are invited to 504 meetings? Some of you. How many are not? Okay, so good. I'm glad to see that, because in some school districts that I talk at, the nurses are not included in the 504 meetings. And for anxiety, it is critical that you be there. Critical that you be there. Because you're seeing these kids. Yeah. So here's just the language, right? I'm uncomfortable. I'm willing to not know what's going to happen. I'm willing to be uncomfortable. Go ahead. I see it.
I just recognize you've done it. This is great, this talk. And there's another subset of kids out there that are showing these it's called behavior disorders.
Uh-huh.
I'm really beginning to wonder, at least for some of them, that it's really driven by anxiety.
Uh-huh.
They don't have the sophistication to be able to say, this is my worry that's causing me
uh-huh.
to
uh-huh.
pop back and do
uh-huh.
things and
uh-huh.
climb under the
uh-huh.
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 You know, and it's kind of... I don't know if you're going to speak about that in a little bit. I don't want to derail what you're talking about now,
well,
because this is so good. But I also
thank you.
Wonder about
those
kids. And,
well, so I come across those kids too, right? And it just depends on sort of their ability, right? So insight, some level of insight is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
If a kid, that metacognition, that ability to step back from your own thinking and evaluate it. And some kids can't do that for a variety of reasons. You don't have to have an explanation. This is where it's helpful to pull out the part and give it another name. So I have a boy that I was seeing, and he, if things didn't go his way, so say he ordered a jacket and it came in the mail and it was too big, he would flip out. And he wouldn't say, well, I'm worried. He wouldn't say that was anxiety. Things didn't go the way he wanted to go. So we can look at that as rigidity, that I need things to go this way because that makes me feel better. That's the rigidity. So we can work on flexibility. How do we handle things flexibly? And we don't even have to use the word worry or anxiety. He named his part swagger. Right? Because Swagger would show up and get all bossy and yell at his siblings, and he might punch his sister when things didn't go the way he needed them to go. So you can be creative with sort of identifying the part. If they're not able to articulate it, and if it's not clear, and that's often the case, then you can call that part anything you want. If a kid is impulsive, if a kid is explosive based on the fact that things don't go the way that they expect them to go and it throws them, they may not recognize that. But you can call that part anything you want. Help them identify the process. So we want to look at when X happens, this is your response. We want X to be as general and process-oriented as possible. So when things don't go the way that you wanted them to go, then you do this. So we're going to work on interrupting that process. Yeah. But the more insight you have, even with adults, right? So if I'm talking to a guy who's had 17 affairs and I go, hey, so, you know, what do you think is going on? He's like, I don't know. You know? Women are hot. You know, you're like, now, maybe, you know, as one of my mentors said, men aren't that deep. Sometimes that's all there is. Don't go looking for more, Lynn, because sometimes you won't find it. So we just have a few more minutes left, and I don't want to interfere with the next presentation, so I'm going to buzz through this stuff. But all the good stuff you've already heard. Let me just say this about, not all the good stuff, but the most important stuff, the breathing thing. So breathing is really important. I love breathing. Everybody should breathe. Here's the problem with what's happening with breathing and anxiety. And if you look at the research on panic attacks, they've been talking about this for 20 years. If the only tool you teach an anxious person or child is breathing, it will not work. Because of everything that I've been talking to you about for the last 2 hours. Breathing gives the message, either explicitly or implicitly, that we need to calm down and eliminate symptoms. If you are a kid and you get ch-ch-ch-ch, it is really hard to then calm down. If you're sitting on the bus and you're afraid that you're going to poop, and somebody says, okay, so do your 10 your therapeutic breathing, you might do it, and then after you do your 10 therapeutic breaths, you are still afraid that you're going to poop. You haven't addressed the process of how the worry works. So the way that I'm going to use breathing, if I use it at all, because I don't teach it to a lot of kids, there are some situations in which it's helpful, is a reboot. When that nervous system gets so out of whack, so dysregulated, and the amygdala is all fired off, and we can't get that prefrontal cortex back online until we regroup. But the goal of regrouping, the goal of doing the breathing, the goal of rebooting is so we can get back on offense. It's not an end. It's not a therapy. It is a reboot. And what's happening is that kids come to see me all the time and they've been to other therapists and I say, well, what did you learn in your previous therapy? We learned breathing exercises. Did they work? Nope. Right? Because here they are. It's not enough. It is enormously helpful sometimes when we do breathing exercises to use it as a way to experientially illustrate the mind-body connection. And that can be kind of fun, particularly with the somatic kids. There's a kid who's having headaches that I'm seeing now, and I talked to the guidance counselor yesterday who had talked to the nurse, and she was in there and she screamed at the nurse, "When Ryan thinks this is stress, and it's not stress!" It is, by the way. And she's got a lot of it, so we understand that. But she is resisting. I need to work with her to help her understand that the mind and the body are connected. And that is not a problem. That is a reality. Nothing happens from here down unless it happens from here up first. The psychiatrist who hired me when I was 22 here told me that. So you can have them imagine that they're taking a half a lemon and biting into a lemon and have them get absorbed in that and imagine that experience and have their mouths water. We could do it together, right? And then it takes away this defensiveness about the mind-body connection. Of course. There are so many things that our bodies do. Give examples, right? I tell kids, I was driving up 93 a few months ago, and a state trooper pulled behind me and turned on his blue lights. I had a physical reaction to that. An immediate physical reaction. He just needed me to move over. But as soon as I looked in my mirror and saw him behind me, my heart rate went boop, and my stomach did that all over the top of the roller coaster thing. When you're embarrassed, you blush. When you blush. Right? All of these things. So being a help kids understand the mind-body connection. You teach them breathing as a way to show them that if they can breathe and you know, imagine or focus on whatever, that they can have an impact on their physical self. It's enormously helpful. But we've got to address the cognitive thing. And the message that is happening over and over and over again is that we use breathing to calm down and that gets rid of worry. It doesn't. It doesn't. It really doesn't. Yeah. It helps with the physical stuff, but it doesn't get rid of the cognitive pattern. That's too powerful. If you are afraid of dogs, breathing will calm you down enough so that you can step into your exposure work. Maybe. But I want kids to step into their exposure work with a high heart rate. Bring it on. Let's go. For kids who get very nauseous, for kids who get faint, for kids who have a lot of the vasovagal thing like I did, the breathing is a really good way to just sort of reset them, truly, so that they feel better in control of their body. But it is much more, I teach, if we looked at all the kids that I see, a few of them have breathing as the tool. So, knowing what you want, how do we get kids to do this? We bribe them. Older kids socially are okay with moving into this because they're seeing the social ramifications of their anxiety. Little kids, sticker charts, if they can come to see you and walk in and say, my worry is bothering me, and so I would like to have you help me talk back to my worry. Oh my gosh, right? You get a point for that. Being able to reward them, being able to show them, they've got to have some skin in the game. There's got to be some reason why they want to do this hard work. For littler kids, it's harder because they're like, no, I like the way this is going. So we have to reward them and bribe them. I have index cards in my office. I'm constantly using them to write messages. Kids need to connect back to their successes. So if you are the person that they come and see a lot, keep a log with them of the things that they've done well and the things that they've managed. And sometimes when they come in to see you, have it just be a success visit or a reminder bridge visit. So the only reason they're coming into your office to talk to you is to report on their successes. And that changes the dynamic. And it changes your relationship with them. The list of accomplishments of things that they know how to do. Every kid has a list. They've learned how to say the alphabet. They've learned how to ride a bike. Start talking to them about their resources and their successes. And then last but not least, you've got to take action on your plan. You've got to make it active. You've got to give them jobs, assignments, things that you can send them off to do. These kids are in your office. Make it count when they're there. It's not about doing the disorder. It's about doing the opposite of what the disorder wants you to do. That's the list. So there are some other things that I could tell you, but it's 2:45, and you have to learn about that. Oh, celiac disease. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.